Listening Dog Media.
DJ. Hello, I'm Chris Hawkins, and this is How to DJ.
How to DJ.
The thing about music where it can just give you goosebumps, that's one of my favourite things to play.
So we sent it on the Tuesday and sent it to his record label, Double FRR, and he played it on the Friday. Then
everything went mad.
I've DJed in great venues all over the world, you know, I mean, the big venues that everyone talks about.
A podcast exploring life stories, techniques, minds and experiences of much-loved DJs, where I ask them to pick five questions from a box of 45. And for this episode, a DJ once described as a prototype of the superstar DJ.
I was thinking if we get 600, we'd be fine. You know, we had like 2,000 the first night.
One of the Ibiza Four.
It was only after we started taking pills that we started going to the clubs with the foreigners in, if you know what I mean.
One of the first DJs in the UK to go digital.
I remember playing some venues and one of them didn't want to pay me because he thought I was cheating.
Nicky Holloway, welcome to How to DJ.
How you doing, Chris? All right?
I'm good, mate, thank you. Before heading into the box of questions, who taught you to DJ, Nicky?
I don't know what it was. I kind of went from being fishing mad. There was a connection here, don't stay with me. From fishing mad and working in a fishing shop in Edmonton, because Don of Edmonton. And then I started going in the record shop. And I started working in the record shop. Then I started working in the clothes shop. And then I started going clubbing. I was sort of 16, 17, 18. And I used to go to a place called The Royalty in Southgate. And the main sort of DJs there were people like Chris Hill, Robbie Vincent, Froggy, and all the big soul mafia DJs from that sort of time. It was kind of the only place where someone 17 could get a drink and get served, you know, when you're underage and you get, you know, not right now, no ID and all that. But there were some fantastic acts where, you know, the Sugar Hill Gang went there, Roy Ayers went there, sort of Anita Ward, all these sort of people all played there, the big records of the time. And I used to stand along the end of the balcony and look down at Froggy and what he was doing with the two decks and that sort of thing. And I remember always saying to myself, I'm going to do that one day. That's what I want to do. You know, I just wanted to be a DJ. And then I didn't really have any equipment at the time, but I started getting my mum's record player and mine next to each other and sellotape with a mic to an upright Hoover, like taped on, and practicing, because I didn't have two decks, but practicing with my mum's deck and my deck, you know, just, you know what I mean? I just sort of, when everyone went out, I just used to nick her record player and put it next to mine and practice.
When I said that you were the prototype superstar DJ, I didn't think it was going back that
far.
Yeah,
I was saying that. I mean, but it kind of like, I started doing this sort of pub night on a Monday night called the Swan and Sugarloaf back in sort of 1983. And that got really popular. We were full up on a Monday night and people were travelling from all over London and South East to go there. And then that built up and built up and built up. And then started doing the Royal Oak in Tooley Street. It's gone now, it's been knocked down, but that had a little basement bar, and I started booking DJs, our lights and stuff, and I started a club called The Special Branch. I mean, we had Pete Tong downstairs and Giles Peterson upstairs, you know, and this is like 1984.
And were you playing as well?
Yeah. Me and Pete used to do every Friday night, you know. I found a load of paperwork. I've been going through boxes and boxes because I've gone back to look after my mum for a little bit, and I found loads of stuff in the loft, and it was like old diaries and put things and pieces like that. It's quite weird reading them. He won't mind me saying this, but I used to pay him about 80 quid and Joel's 50 at the start. I mean, you imagine that now. But it was like, they weren't household names then. That went for a good few years, and we started doing things called the Do at the Zoo. We did about 16 of them, and there was like, that went up. So it started building up, and we did other events called the Do's, and we did Chislehurst Caves and Thorpe Park and Church of Crypt in Deptford, all like the weird, odd venues, Natural History Museum.
How old were you at the time?
I was probably only 20, 22, 23.
So still learning your trade.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. What happened with the big leap for me came, you know, there was a sort of, it was mostly a soul and funk scene and jazz scene then. And then when it all sort of started to turn around, sort of 86, 87, with the house thing, what happened was we were doing these things at the Zoo. We didn't get the license for one of them, but we'd already sold the event out. It was 2,000 people already bought tickets. And so like 2 days before, we'd been told we haven't got a license. So what do? Give everyone their money back. The Astoria Charing Cross Road, I had a band called Slave On, and they'd only sold 300 tickets. And I thought, well, that crosses over to our crowd. So we put on loads of coaches and told everybody on the night, they all turned up in the zoo, turned everyone on the night and get on the coach and took them to the Astoria instead, which had a later license. Yeah, they could have their money back if they wanted to, but nobody did. Everyone came to the Astoria. But because of that, because of a bit of bad luck, it got my foot in the door of the Astoria. And then that's how I'd done a couple of other one-offs there, Easter and things like that. And then when that came along, that's when I got the Astoria on Saturday nights, which was like the first big proper Saturday night doing the Acid House thing, you know.
What were you getting paid then yourself?
Well, I was running the show, so I was walking out the door with 10 grand in cash and going to warehouse parties. I don't know where it all went, but it's gone. I do know where it went, actually. I wasn't thinking about the VAT man. So after a few years, when I get that knock on the door, oh, I didn't think about saving 17.5% of all the door takings for the VAT man. I'll get hit with these massive, great big VAT bills, which don't. That's where the first house went.
And you were partying hard as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You never think, well, the thing is, when you're like 23, 24, or that, you never think it's going to end. You're quite fearless in them days. When people said to me, you know, oh, you can't do that, you go, yeah, I can. And you do it. Whereas later in life, you start thinking about the consequences of doing it, you know. Like, we was sitting around my house, fun enough, with Brandon one morning. And it was when Euro Disney first opened, they weren't very busy. It was like dead. There wasn't getting many people there. So I thought, wouldn't it be good if we do a party Euro Disney? So I got on the phone to them. Somebody contacted them, went over to their office, we'd done a deal. They gave us all their logos, stuff like that. And we put an event on with like D-Ream and, well, the lineup for it was we had like sort of two DJs from every country in Europe, you know, Sven Vaff, like Oki and Sasha and, you know, all different people, Dimitri from Holland and Ralph and Coccoluto from Italy. You know, it was called Dance Europe. Then about 2 weeks before, or no, about a month before the event was went to play, we had like 2,500 people coming to it because we were going to use the official Disney hotel, one of their hotels. They pulled the plug on it because they were getting phone calls from people like The Sun and places like that about this Acid House party at Disney. So they got cold feet. Somehow someone in America got wind of it and said, we don't want that sort of thing, our thing and all that. So we thought, what do we do? I mean, they had basically paid us a load of money to go away because we had proper contracts with them. It was all done like that. So they gave us, you know, quite a lump of money to go away. And if we'd just gone away, I would have made some money, but we didn't. We went and found a farmer with a field, put some marquees up and still did it anyway. We bought 2,000 tickets for Disney, which you can use any day, you know, so people could still go to the Disney if they wanted in the day. But we did it. They've got some rule in the Marlow Valley. You can't have a hotel within 10 miles of Disney. And so we went, I remember going over there. I don't speak a word of French, but I went over there with a pile of cash, went round all these hotels around the edge of Disney, about 8 hotels we took over, and said, and they went, Bosh, you know, I had to walk into them and say, can we book the whole hotel? You know, but people did stick with it, and they, you know, because we coached, a lot of them came on coaches and stuff. I think it worked out that only about the third of the people that came to the event actually bothered going to Disney. But, you know, it was pissing with rain that weekend as well. Squeaky bum time. That was because council got wind of it, of this rave going on. They didn't know if we were a load of football hooligans or something like that. And we've got like 2,000 people in all these hotels waiting for the event to start. And then there's 20 local councillors at the venue all sitting around a big table deciding whether or not the event could go on. And they're all in the hotels. And me and the partner was walking up and down going, no, this can't be happening. This cannot be happening. Because they've got some weird law where they all have to agree. It's something like if one person disagrees, they have to stick there and keep arguing out until they change their mind. When it did open, down the bottom of the road was 2 big coach loads of gendarmes. The first night that was. And then later on in the evening, I was standing there having a drink with the top copper, and he was fine. He was happy and all that. And the next day, there was no police there. It was just they were worried that there was going to be like 2,000 English football hooligans there or something like that. And it would be from, but like literally, I can remember standing there afterwards at the end, was on with the head copper, you know, and he having a stand there having a beer with him, and he was at me, and the next night, no, you didn't see one. But that was a scary moment. That was, you know, what, I don't know what we'd have done. I think they probably realised that there would have been trouble if that if it hadn't gone on. They probably weighed that one up, thinking, imagine it, like all in their hotel rooms waiting to go to a party, and then it gets cancelled. They would have all gone nuts, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
We did a thing where everybody had to put like 20 quid in as a deposit for their rooms in case damage or anything like that. And, it, you know, if there's four of you in a room, that's 80 quid that you're going to lose. And it was a bit like the other people stopped the one that's doing the damage, didn't they? So it kind of worked. We never got one bill from one hotel for anything. We never had one complaint from any of the hotels out of 2,000 people. A little antidote to that story. Daft Punk came down there and they gave their first demo tape to the Soma Boys, you know, or Michael, their first label they had. So they basically came there. They were French. And they came down there to give their demo tapes to some of the people there. And that's how they got their first record deal. It was a label called Soma up in Glasgow with Stuart and Ord. And they signed their first record, I think, because they gave him the tape and he listened to it. And that's how that started. I've actually, the only reason I knew that is because I read it in one of their articles that they said.
You've been at the start of a lot, haven't you, through your career. What do you remember about the start of Acid House?
Oh, I don't know what you say about it. I kind of knew it was my generation at the time. You know, it was our Woodstocky like vibe. You know, it was something that I knew we were going to be telling our kids about it in the future.
You sensed that then? Because Obviously that's easy to say in retrospect.
Yeah. Well, it kind of, you know, after the Beefer, and there was a big crowd of people that just wanted to come back and have that vibe going on in England. And, you know, Paul started out doing the Spectrum thing and Danny started the Zoom and then I started the Trip. And it was almost like snowballing overnight. It was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then all the phone number raves and all the big outdoor stuff and it. And it was just like almost weekly overnight, just doubling. And the first night of the Astoria, we didn't open the upstairs up originally because I didn't know if we was going to fill it. I was thinking if we get 600, we'd be fine. You know, we had like 2,000 the first night and it went from there. I was like, you know, in a weird kind of way, you talk about luck. The only two big things that, like, there wasn't all the media and that there is now, and all the internet and all that social media. The only things that people read were like, if you're in London, it was Time Out, then it was ID magazine and the Face magazine. They're the only places you could sort of look to get any advertising. You know, Radio 1 weren't playing any dance music in them days. You know, like maybe the odd one would get played. It just so happened. It wasn't planned. Nowadays people sit down and work a marketing plan out. There was no marketing plan. It was just kept falling into things. And the first day we opened, it was it was last week of May, and all those started glossy magazines come out about the third week of the month. You know, they come out about a week before the actual original date on it. And both of them carried two or three page articles about this new developing scene. So like the two, I didn't know that was going to happen. Just like the timing could have not have been more perfect. The two big style mags of the day run big features, two or three page big colour features on this scene the week we opened the club.
You became known as one of the Ibiza Four, didn't you? So that was you. It was
Paul Oakenfold, yeah. Danny Ramplin and Johnny Walker.
Yeah. What was your first time in Ibiza like?
I'd been going there for like years before that, just going to all the little English clubs. I've been going there since like 82. I took a load of people there in 85, I think it was 84, 85, before the house, and we went with a soul crowd and stuff. So it was only after we started taking pills that we started going to the clubs with the foreigners in, if you know what I mean, because we used to just stick to where the English people went. And then after that, sort of, we started getting into other things. We were going into Pasha and Coup and, you know, Amnesia and that, you know, and all those clubs and seeing another side of things. And I've still got friendships with people from Holland, Germany, Argentina, Belgium, Spain, all from those days still. You know, still in touch with loads of them. Just open people's minds a bit.
Was it you or the Hacienda DJs who brought house music to the UK?
That's funny, one that gets asked a lot. Here's a little thing for you. The opening night of Trip, Dystoria, who do you think I booked?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they had Takeaway and Graham Park.
From the Hacienda?
No, I had the Hacienda DJs down on the opening night. So, we sort of paid homage to that, if you like. I mean, because it was always that thing of who was the first one. I think it might have been played up there before it was in London, but I think coming to London took it to the next level, if you know what I mean. But no, I've always known those people. I mean, they flew me up to the Hacienda, like, to do a thing, what's my name, Tony, the bloke who run it.
Tony Wilson?
Yeah, Tony Wilson. Yeah, he used to come to the club when he was in town already. I met him a good few times up there. Funny thing is, I know it was good, the Hacienda, that I only went there 3 times, and every time I went, it was crap. It was just, they were just like either one-off nights that didn't work. It was nothing to do with the venue, but it was just, it wasn't like you see on the things. It was just odd nights I'd done where I got booked to play there.
You're not the only person to say
that. Yeah, it was like Tuesday night or Thursday night where someone's hired it to do something and all that, you know. And I'm talking, that's like, 86, 87, around that time. Ange was there. Ange Meth, was it? Yeah, she was there at that time. So I never actually saw it being good, but I know it was because I've seen loads of things since.
What was the height of the craziness for you in that second Summer of Love?
I did remember standing there on stage at Dystoria, and I did think to myself, probably ain't going to get a lot better than this, because not only is it packed and all dancing and I'm DJing, and Tongy done it with me every week as well, I was just thinking, where can I go now with it, I don't know what. So we did start doing some weekenders and stuff, but the fact that I was making the money as well, which is, I'd never seen that sort of money before, I was teen, I was taking a doorman. Of course, I blew it, because I didn't know how to handle it, I never saved for a rainy day, just carried on going,
How much were you partying yourself?
Oh, well, that sort of time, probably all the time. It did get to me in the end. I mean, after this story, we bought the small place across the road, and that became the Milk Bar. And then when that had to close, because they were always going to be doing what they've done there now, we're knocking it all down. That was always going to happen even 30 years ago. And so you only ever had short leases. So you built up like successful clubs, but you didn't have anything to sell because it wasn't worth anything for anyone wanting to buy it. And then when we lost the Milk Bar, we found a venue around the corner from it, like literally stone's throw away, and that became the Velvet Underground. And then we got the old Milk Bar back again because they didn't need the root thing yet. So that became Mars. So there was three things in that time. So I was at that whole corner where I was, and within literally a stone's throw of each other, I had 3 places on the go at different times, and they've all been knocked down now. They're not even there. I came out the station just now at Top Court Road, and I didn't know where I was. It's changed so much. I couldn't get my bearings. And I spent every night in Soho for like 10, 15 years, and I got lost. Where am I? Is it just gone?
Who were your DJs?
Well,
other than Pete Tong, who were your DJs?
Oh, yeah, loads of people. I think it was the first person to have Kevin Saunderson, first person to have Todd Terry, first person to have Dave Morales, first person to have Derek Mayon, Stonebridge, even then, yeah, West Bam, all these people, before anyone knew their names, we had them on. You remember the record Turntable Orchestra, you're going to miss me when I'm gone, right? Well, I didn't realise he was the DJ, and I booked what I thought was Turntable Orchestra. It was Hippie Tirales, right? And when he turned up, he thought he was to play, and I booked it because I wanted the PA, and he'd never done one before. But I got him to do it. He did it. He smashed it out, and it went down great. But it was like, I think something along the lines got mixed up. We had loads of people on before anyone knew their names, In the place we had Tony Humphries, We started up in the Velvet and the Milk Bar. We had top drum and bass nights as well. Fabio and Groove did all the nights there. And, I think we had most of them. And we had a couple of good gay nights for Fat Tony, Done Fierce Child. And we had a big lipstick lesbian night as well called Kitty Lips. So it was quite, to get, to fill it every night in a week, it was pretty good. I mean, it's hard to imagine now. If you think of one time it was a Monday night, the Milk Bar lineup was Monday night, it was myself and Darren Emerson, and then later Paul Harris. And then Tuesday nights was private hire things. Wednesday night was Danny Ramblin's Pure Sexy Night. Thursday night was live band nights. And the first four bands we had was Jamiroquai, Brand New Heavies, Man Called Adam and James Taylor Quartet. Right? And they, you know, imagine that. It was full band, but they weren't famous then. It's not as famous as they are. And then Friday nights was me and Paul Oaken, right? Saturday was Deirdre and Pete Tong. And Sunday night was Brandon Block and Lisa Loud. I mean, that's the whole week, you know, every night. You know what I mean?
I mean, even when you say it out loud,
yeah.
Do you feel like it's kind of
when I look
like,
at
unbelievable?
Burn these old flyers and look at it, you know, what's on and all that. Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, I don't think any venue could do that now to pull off that many sort of, you know, nice. I think also as well, there was a lot of different things then. I mean, you know, it's like the only places with late licences were in the West End, and people used to come at the West End, you know, they'd have a drink around the local area, all meet and come in. And now they've all got late licences in the suburbs. And I think that sort of people can't be, and they've messed up all the parking and all that around. It's a complete mess, the West End traffic-wise now. They're supposed to have made it better and they've made it worse.
Was there a time that you sensed that you were losing control then?
I found a new venue, funny enough, in the West End. I really wanted to move it into there. And after a year farting about and planning it all and getting it all ready and stuff, we didn't get the planning permission, got knocked back. You know, we probably would have got it on appeal, but I'd run out of money by then. You know, in the year that I was sort of off doing that, putting all the money into trying to get this venue licence, because we had the lease on it and we had a year's rent free in order to get planning permission. And there was no objection from the police, no objection from the fire, there was no objection from anyone, except the council just said no. They didn't want it to happen. It's still not a venue. And it was such a brilliant place. It was like four floors of that. And it was where all the orchestras in the West End, before you know, sound and that, they'd have an orchestra in the pit at the front, wouldn't they? And they would all meet up at this clubhouse thing and get told, right, tonight you're in the windmill, tonight you're over there and all that. So it was like their job in orchestra players, and they would send them, right, we want a violinist to go there. And on the wall was a really big, big sort of mural statue thing of the band that played on when the Titanic sank. Because, you know, they're saying, because they played on while it went down, didn't they? And so they had that as a sort of homage thing in this orchestra place. And that would have been behind the DJ box where it was. It would have been so good. I found it actually makes me feel sick when I thought I found a big folder with all the pictures in it and all the plans and all the ideas I had and all that. And, you know, it makes me physically sick to look at them because it was my dream and it didn't happen, you know, and I've been building up to something bigger like that. And it just all fell apart. And I was drinking and sniffing too much and all that and times and all that. And I just ran out of money and ended up all my stuff in storage, not really getting that much work, living on my mate's sofa. You know what I mean? It was like, what happened? Where's it all gone? You know, and so that was kind of when basically I had to go hands up and, you know, got us into a rehab thing. And I did a month in one of them places, you know, like Charlton Nightingale Hospital. And then I sort of stayed sober for 7 years after that. And kind of bit by bit got things back together.
And the phone started ringing again.
Yeah, it did a bit. Yeah, I mean, that goes on and off. Just when I think it's all over, right, then the phone rings and something comes in. You know, like, so it's like I can go like, you know, a month without a gig and then have four the next month, you know, that sort of thing. So I'm still getting booked. It's not like it used to be, but, you know, I'm still getting a good sort of, you know, one or two a month that are pretty decent, you know.
What do you think about that tag, the prototype to the superstar DJ?
Well, I don't know about that really, because I never got the money that they are doing now. What they get now, it's, you know, I can't believe it. I mean, but I don't know if they do. You never know whether people just tell fibs anyway, and they all like, it's like all these people need all these influencers and all that. You know, it's like a big lie going all the way down through the system. They say they've got 20,000 when they've probably got two, you know, and then the person who's selling it to the ad agencies, you know, the company sells it to the ad agencies and they've got 200,000, and then the ad agency sells it to the actual advertiser and there's 2 million. So they just, and who's policing them to know what the actual figures are? It's in the interests of the social media companies to keep adding noughts on to make, you know what I mean? And then all the way through, nuts on, you know. But like, you can buy a million likes anyway, you know, if you know where to go.
You are still DJing, though.
Yeah.
In more recent years, where have been your best residencies?
Well, because what happened back in, going back there in 92 things, well, I ended up having a bar in Pasha as well, in Ibiza, one in Pasha and a milk bar in San Antonio. So this is like 92, before Spain was even in Europe. And there was in there every night with Alfredo and stuff. And I residency, I suppose my own were my favourites, because yeah, they probably were out of residencies. I had the DJ box and I wanted it. You know, I had a...
Go on, tell a story.
A mini bar in there, my own little toilet in the DJ box.
Yeah, so know. I want to know about that toilet.
Oh, that fuck, yeah, oh, dear, Dan. I went to the toilet one night, got chat to someone in there, and I put a long track on, thinking I'd be back in time, right? But when I came out, people were all looking at me and going, what's the matter, was it? The record was stuck and it was jumping. I can remember it, what it was. It was Maria Carey, like Dream Lover, right? And it'd been going on for about 3 or 4 minutes. It'd been just been hitting it like that. And the DJ box was locked because it had a lock on it. So now I could get in there to change it. So I thought, fuck that. You know, I'm going to get a little mini toilet, like a little portaloo thing. And there wasn't really much way of doing it. So we cut a hole in the wood, put a carpet tile over the front of it. It was just a funnel going into a jerry can. You know, and at the night we'd empty it. No, because you know what I mean? You can't keep going through the crowd every time to get the toilet. It worked really well. You know, I put a mini bar in there. It was easier than having a bar tab to give them a little fridge, you know, and put stuff in it like that. But it was my little home, that thing, because I designed all the clubs. It was done because how I wanted it, if you like, you know. But I don't know. I think it's a younger man's game. I mean, I don't think I'd want to be out 6 nights a week that summer. You know, I was in my 20s, the 20s to 30s, you know. The thought of having to go out every night now, like, oh, no, thank you.
I don't think anyone misses lugging record bags around,
either. No. And it was record bags in them days, yeah. You know. I don't know how we got away with it. I mean, all the countries I went to, I had a little count up the other day. I found an old map of the world and I started putting little crosses on it of where all the places I've been. And I found another wallet of actual flight tickets. You know, I used to get a ticket, done now. And I started pinning them on it and all that. And it's good because when I'm doing a bit of a book, it's going to give me the actual dates of things, you know, for a timeline on it. I used to get on the planes with two boxes of records and they weigh 20 kilos each. Now you're only allowed 20 kilos. So it was like 40 kilos in records. And plus big case of stuff. So, like, you're probably looking at least 60, 70 kilos, and no one really seemed to mind. Do you know what I mean? We used to get, don't know how we got away with it, but we did.
How do you feel about the way it's all turned out?
It's a lot easier now with sticks, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was the first person I know in the country to DJ with the digital stuff. I remember playing some venues and they one of them didn't want to pay me because he thought I was cheating. I remember even Tongi and Sasha taking the mickey out of me for it. Like, and then a year later, they're all doing it. Yeah, because this is pre like CDJs and that. Well before that, it was like the first one was Vinyl Scratch, it was called. You know, the first one where you could play the files with the vinyl and stuff. And that got bought out by Native Instruments and became Traktor. But no, that was before. But so when it was in its infancy days, it only ran on Linux, like the operating system Linux, you know. And that didn't have a little sort of time thing on it. I remember I plugged it into a socket in the DJ box that wasn't working. So in front of 2,000 people, it just died because the battery on the laptop had gone. It just went boom.
Have you always enjoyed messing with the technology?
Do you know what? That came from sobering up. Like during that 7-year period, you know, someone gave me a laptop and then I got on the internet and started messing around. And then, you know, the Napster and the MP3 thing came around. And then I started building my own computers. I still build my own. And if I ever want to make a PC, I still put it together myself from the bits. I enjoy doing it. I've done about 40 PCs. I quite enjoy it. I go to the old computer fair. Geeks shall inherit the earth, you know. No, I just do. I do quite like us. If you're building it for a studio, a music setup, you don't want all the same things from the same company. You know what I mean? I thought of buying an app or not being able to change it if something goes wrong. If mine breaks down, I open it up and fix it, you know?
When you look back on all of what we've talked about, how do you feel like it's all turned out?
I don't know how I feel. I might feel probably a bit like, You know these 60s and 70s footballers who see all the youngsters now making all this money and they're looking back thinking, well, we got like £300 a week, you know, you're on £30,000 a week or whatever. I feel a little bit like that. I mean, I have noticed, though, that it's not the innovators and the people that come up with the ideas that make the money. It's the ones that come second. The ones that go in off once you've paved the way and opened the door for it. You know, it's quite often with everything, it's the ones that come second, come first.
Yeah.
In the end.
Do you still get the same buzz when you DJ now as you ever did?
If it's a good night, yeah. If it's a good night. I mean, you know, most of the things I do are pretty decent, you know. I mean, the thing is, it's like, as far as deep being a good DJ, what is a good DJ? I mean, anyone could play to a packed house. That's easy. You know, when you've only got a third full thing and it's like, you know, and you're not sure what to do and all that. And then you turn that night round into being a really good night. That's when you've pat yourself on the back, not when you've got like a sea of heads in the front that are just going to, you know, you could fart on the mic and they'd cheer, you know. But when you've got an half-full club and you've got to work to keep them there before they go off somewhere else or do something else, that's when it's hard. But that's how I judge a DJ.
For this series, we've teamed up with Flare Audio to ask our guests for their favourite song to listen to through earphones. So, Nicky Holloway, what is the track that you think is perfect for solo listening?
Solo listening? Right, yeah, but it's still in stereo, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd just say stick on Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, if you want an experience, you know. It's just, I've had that album since it came out, and I don't think there's a year goes by where I don't sit down and listen to it once or twice. Because sonically, it's just bang on.
Amazing. It's time for the first of your five picks from 45 now in this record box. All of the questions are on 45 Steve's. I'll dip into the box. You say when. I'll pull out your questions, okay?
All right.
So say when.
When.
If you could have any other job in the world.
I'm scared now.
If you could have any other job in the world, what would it be?
I suppose I'd like to have worked in a big old school recording studio with a massive great SSL desk doing all that side of things. You know, producing. I'm producing loads of music myself for my own thing at the moment.
Isn't there an album coming?
Well, it's not a album, it's five albums. There's like 40, 50 tracks on it. And each one's slightly different. You know, one's sort of like a darker Trigger Warning. That's called Trigger Warning. That's got like, well, I can't imagine any Ofcom stations playing it because there's always naughty things on that one. And then there's Discombobulate, which is more soulfully disco-y stuff. And then there's a chill-out one, you know, Cafe Del Nick. And then there's another one called Walk of Shame, which are basically pop records redone. You're like, well, they're dance records, but you'll get about 2 or 3 minutes into them before you even realise what it is. You know what I mean? And then the song comes in. But there's some interesting stuff on it. Because it's like they'd be dancing and then they realise what they're dancing to. You know, it's that sort of stuff.
Back into the box for your second question. Okay, say what?
God, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Who is your favourite DJ, past or present?
Oh. Probably the one that I remembered the most of, Chris Hill, who's an old soul DJ. Because he was the guy he was the big star of the day, and he was an entertainer as well. He you know, he was really into his music, played really good music, knew how to command a room, and I learnt a lot from him. Reading a room, you know, like working it out by sussing out who's going to like what, who's going to right. If I play to the girls, then the blokes will start dancing, all that sort of stuff. You know, like you kind of focus. Sometimes you can just focus in on two or three people on that dance floor, and you're feeding off them. You know, because you know, you see they're enjoying it and all that, and you can work out if you're losing things. I'll just think probably Chris Hill if I had to pick one. Yeah.
All right. Back into the box for a third question, Nicky. Say when?
Got it.
Here you go then. Question three. What do you wish you'd never done?
All my money on drugs. Well, not all of it, but a good chunk of it. what's that saying? I think it was George Best, and he said, what did you do with all your money? It was like, I raced cars, fondled women, went on good holidays, drove fast cars, and the rest I squandered, you know. I didn't really think about it. I'm the only person I know who's lost money. Only person in the world I know that's lost money on three houses. I've owned three properties in my life and lost money on every one. I don't know anyone that's ever done that. You know, first time it's like the interest rates went up to like 17, 15%. That was the first one I lost and I just gave the keys back. I just seemed to always buy just at the height of everything and then there was always a crash just after it. You know, like even the last flat I had was when the last banking crash happened. And just like, it's like, who's lost money on 3 houses and 2 flats? I'm not very good with money.
Back into the box, Nicky, for question 4.
Say what?
Got it.
Question 4 is, what's the best technical change since you started DJing?
Well, I suppose the digitalization thing of it all. I mean, you know, the fact that you could carry 200 records in 2 record boxes. I suppose in one way it made you have to play from those boxes, but when you're travelling and going to all different places, the fact that you can have thousands of things with you, you know, does give you that option to, because I've done gigs where you think it's quite often you in your head you think it's going to be like that, and when you get there, it's not like that. You know, there's like the things that you wanted to play, you know, ain't going to work. So, you know, it's nice to have that backup of being able to switch to a different, slightly different genre, you know, if you can. But technically, I suppose that's it, really.
As a single biggest change, yeah.
Yeah.
Your final question from the box, Nicky. Say yeah. When?
Yeah. Go on.
All right. This one's signed by...
I was going to say,
signed by Brandon Block.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and the question on it is... what's the greatest club night ever?
Oh. That's not an easy one, is it? Oh, fuck God. Do you know, I've got a brain freeze on that one. I can't think of one that's like, jumps out at me as, you know, it'd be a bit too conceited to say my own one, isn't it?
Oh, no, that's fine.
Trip.
You're Nicky Holloway.
Yeah, trip, yeah. And it seems a bit like, you know, but mind you, it's only bragging if you haven't done it, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I've done so many things, you know, I've done like, over the years. Do you know what will happen? When I'm on a train going home, I'll think of them.
Well, and in that case, can we agree now that you'll come back on sometime?
Yeah, no problem.
Nicky, it's the end of the world and there's some kind of catastrophic event with a caveat that you've got to play the last 3 records on Earth. What would they be?
I know people are going to laugh at this, but it's just given me so much joy over the years. It would be Alison Limerick, Where Love Lives, you know. The original mix of that, because just because it's like, it's probably something that for 30 years or whatever it is now, if you get in trouble, you can stick it on and it works, you know. The obvious one would be Promised Land. No, I don't know anyone who don't like that record. Do you know what I mean? It's probably well overplayed, but I don't know anyone that don't. And maybe even Voodoo Ray as well. Ooh. Not the original mix, the Knuckles and Morales one. But off the bat, I mean, they're 3 classics, obvious classics, but they're ones like, you know, like Tools of the Trade that you have with you just in case.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Bankers.
Yeah.
Nicky Holloway, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that was How to DJ.
How to DJ. How to DJ.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow us wherever you get your podcast from.